Right, on behalf of the Economics Department, I'm delighted to welcome everyone here this evening. As the turnout indicates, Bjørn Lomborg's reputation runs before him. Bjørn Lomborg wrote an article back in 1998 about the state of our environment, which generated a series of articles all around the world and led to the publication of The Skeptical Environmentalist in 2001, which was then published in 10 languages. He was described as one of the 50 stars of Europe in Business Week 2002 and one of the 100 most influential people by Time Magazine in 2004. So I think he needs no further introduction. We're delighted that his talk this evening will be discussed first by Dr. Mark Maslin of University College London, who began his career at University College London as a lecturer in geography, paleoclimatology, and physical geography, and who has been a consultant for Greenpeace UK, among his many other distinctions, and who has written a very, very large number of papers on all aspects of climate and related issues. Our second discussion this evening will be Professor Julian Hunt. Lord Hunt is Professor of Climate Modeling in the Department of Space and Climate Physics and Geological Sciences at University College London, where he's also an Honorary Professor of Mathematics. He was Director General and Chief Executive of the Meteorological Office from 1992 to 1997 and became a Fellow of the Royal Society in 1989. I would like to indicate that Bjørn Lomborg will speak for about half an hour, and then our two discussants will speak for about 10 minutes. We're going to allow lots of time for questions this evening, and so I will give the floor without further ado to Bjørn Lomborg.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to be talking about Copenhagen consensus and basically try to answer, or at least give a sense of how we might go about answering the question, if we can't do everything, what should we do first? And the idea is really to try to bring you into why we did this event, what the result was, what some of the other things that we've been trying to do, and what I think is the future of this argument. So it's basically both trying to convince you that this might be a viable way of thinking about the world's problems and prioritization of the world's problems, but just as much also of saying that it has a lot of future uses and a lot of different ways that we could go about it. I should just say before I go any further, all of what I'm talking about here you can see at much greater length at our webpage, which is www.copenhagenconsensus.com. So it has all the information, all the background papers and everything. But just to start out, I think it's important to say that what led me to start even having this discussion about Copenhagen consensus was to say there's lots of problems out there in the world. It's important also just to link it up to my previous work where I say that a lot of things have gotten better. That's true. There are a lot fewer people who are starving in the world today than there was, say, 50 years ago. But it doesn't mean that there's not still a lot of people starving. There are a lot of problems out there in the world, and I've tried to just list a few of them up here. 800 million people starving, 1 billion people lacking clean drinking water, 2 billion lacking sanitation, and on, all the way down to several billion people who will be severely affected by global warming. So the whole idea is to say there's still lots and lots of problems in the world. Now, in an ideal world, we'd love to fix them all. We'd love to say, okay, let's fix all these issues. But clearly, we don't. We don't actually solve all problems. And so if we do not solve all problems, I think it is reasonable to start saying, well, where should we start? What should be the first things we want to do? Where can we do the most good first? So our sort of initial question was to say, what if you had another, say, $50 billion? And it's important to say it's just a number. It's not necessarily $50 billion, but it's to give you a sense of saying, if you have a limited amount of extra money to do good with, what would you do? It's also important to say that what we were talking about was extra funds. We were not talking about, let's reshuffle the whole world and let's start all over and then do the whole program. That would make sense. It would probably be very methodologically very, very hard. It would be a very, very different outcome from what we did now. We were saying, given that the world does everything it does today, what should we do extra? Where should we add a little bit to do even more good? So what we tried to do was to say, well, what are the problems in the world? We first all identified 32 problems from all the UN publications, essentially assuming that if there is a big problem out there, some UN organization ought to have looked at it. We also had some focus groups. We came up with about 32 global problems. We had to whittle them down simply for practicalities. These were the 10 challenges we discussed. Most people seem to be fairly comfortable with these 10 challenges, certainly in the sense that most people tend to say, yeah, those are the right ones, except the one that I'm studying, which ought to be the 11th. But yeah, most of the time it actually works out. Then, of course, the point here is to say, which of these should we be doing? You know, the intuition is to say, well, which of these is the most important one? And that's certainly how much of media portrays most of the world's problems. But of course, that's not the right way to ask the question, because it doesn't make sense to say, what's the biggest problem, unless you can actually solve it, unless you actually think about how you can solve it. Probably the world's biggest problem is that we all die, but we don't have a good technology to avoid that. So it's not really the right answer to say, well, the biggest problem in the world is that we all die. The issue should be not to try to look at what are the biggest problems, but what are the best solutions. So that was really what we tried to look at. And of course, that does make it a little more complicated when you start talking about what are the best solutions to the world's problems. The good news is that we do know a lot about how to solve the world's problems. We do know solutions to climate change. Well, that could, for instance, be, all right, partial solutions, I should say. None of these solutions are absolute solutions that just simply solve the whole problem, but they go some way towards solving the problem. So for climate change, it could be Kyoto. It could be a $100 carbon tax. For communicable diseases, it could be health clinics or mosquito nets. For conflicts, it could be investment in UN peacekeeping forces, and so on. So the point is, many of these problems we can actually solve. Not all of them, not certainly equally efficiently, but we do know a lot of different solutions. The bad news, I think, is to say that most of these all cost money, that they actually strain on our resources. We have to do a lot of work, both politically, but most certainly, and this was the predominant issue at the Copenhagen Consensus, on money. We actually have to end up spending money on providing the health clinics or the mosquito nets or the UN peacekeeping forces, or money in the sense that if we put $100 in carbon tax, it does mean that our economy takes a blow. So the idea here is, again, to say, if this all costs money, we're back to the discussion of saying, well, where do we want to spend our money first? So these were the ideas that we tried to put up. And then we basically tried to come up with what should be the big priorities. I want to just start off with saying, why on earth has nobody done this before? In a sense, it seems like such an obvious idea to say, hey, if we can't do it all, what should we do first? I think it's to a very large extent because prioritization is very uncomfortable. It's unpleasant. Nobody wants to do this because everybody would love to be number one, but everybody would hate to be anything but number one. And since logic dictates that there's going to be a lot more not number ones on any one list, it means that it's a bad idea to start getting yourself into. And yet, we do still prioritize. Politicians do prioritize. That is what politics is about. At the end of the day, we do end up prioritizing. So in a very basic sense, what we see ourselves as is really just saying, right now, politicians get a lot of information from natural scientists telling us there are lots of problems out there. There are lots of solutions to these are the kinds of things that we can do. Then politicians have to make a decision. But in a sense, it's a little bit like getting a menu without prices. It's seeing all these great things you can do, but you have no idea what the prices are. You have no idea what the sizes are. Imagine if you went into a restaurant and wanted to order a pizza, but you had no idea if it's going to be an individual size one or a family one, or if it's going to cost £1 or £1,000. That would be a little disquieting, right? And so the idea here really is to say what Copenhagen Consensus can do, and having this discussion about priorities, can start putting prices and sizes on the menu so that politicians and also us in the democracy will have a better opportunity to actually make these kinds of decisions. So the idea was to say prioritization is one key word, rationality is the other one, to utilize an immense amount of knowledge. I'm sorry, I've been traveling for too long, so I've given away all my books. But we did write a very, very long book. It's about 700 pages filled with lots of arguments about all the things we know. And when I give it out to politicians or other people, their eyes typically glaze over, and they're like, I'm never going to read this book. Right? But the brilliant thing is that you say, well, we can use all this knowledge. We can bring it into a very easily easily understandable format, we can actually end up giving people a list of priorities and saying, well, if you look at all the evidence, this is likely to be the top priority, this is likely to be number 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. And so actually, I can ask everyone to just flip to page 606, I know this by now, 606 and read half a page and then you're done. So in a sense, now of course that's not exactly how it works, right? But in a sense, this I think is a very, very efficient way of trying to communicate an immense amount of knowledge that we do have about all the world's problems and how to solve them, in order to also get them to be politically relevant, in order to not only inform our politicians, but also our democratic discussion about what should we do first. So this really is a way of utilizing prioritization, utilizing rationality, using our knowledge, and getting it across to people so that we have a better understanding of what it is that we should try to do. Just to briefly describe the process, what we tried to do was to take some of the world's top economists in each of these areas. So we took one of the world-class economists on climate change, one of the world-class economists on communicable diseases, one on conflicts, and so on. Had them write a paper, overview paper, about 50 pages on what we know about what's the problem, what can be done, what are the best things to do, and how much would they cost, and how much good would they do. That was not a small task for them to do. They did so magnificently, and I think those are broadly recognized as really good papers in their individual fields. Of course, you all know academics. They have a tendency slightly to go off on their own little thing, so we also wanted to make sure that we stayed on track, so we also asked two opponents, also world-class economists in each of these areas, so two world-class economists on climate change, two in communicable diseases, and so on, also to chip in and make sure that we got all the representation of the individual issues. So we had 30 specialist economists writing about climate change, communicable diseases, and so on. But the point is, of course, if you want to know what's the more important thing to do first, to do something about climate change or do something about malaria, you don't ask a malaria expert or a climatologist, because essentially you wouldn't be surprised if they come up with saying, well, it's malaria or climate, right? The point is, of course, you have to ask some people who are going to look across the board, and that was what we used the dream team for. We published with Cambridge University Press. They decided to call them the Real Madrid of economics. I hear that Real Madrid is not doing very well anymore, so maybe it's not such a good thing. Certainly it does no good for me in the U.S. because they have no idea what I'm talking about. But the basic idea was these were some of the world's top economists. We used to have three Nobel laureates. One of them just got the Nobel Prize this year, so we also say that if you want to participate in Copenhagen Consensus, it's apparently not bad for your career. But bottom line, you know, four of them Nobel laureates, but all of them very, very smart people, and very, very good at looking at all these different areas. So basically what we did, we tried to have all the papers telling us everything we know about these individual issues. We had them all meet up 5 days in Copenhagen, meet with all the experts, ask them all the hard questions, and say, sure, your model says this, but have you included this? Have you included this? Do we believe in this? Do we believe that the right evaluation, for instance, for human life or whatever, it should be this? Trying to standardize across these very many different areas. Of course, that's a huge task, and in a sense, that's exactly why we ask Nobel laureates. At the end of the day, at least we feel slightly more comfortable that they will be able to make those very, very huge and demanding assumptions across the board on all these different issues. And at the end of the day, ask them to come out with a prioritized list. We did not ask them to agree. You probably all know the quote by, I think it's Truman, who said that, oh, please give me a one-armed economist, right? Because he was so annoyed by the economist being on the one hand, on the other hand. But the surprising thing was that all of these economists, although we asked them for their individual prioritization, and what our argument was then with the Copenhagen Consensus outcome would just simply be that we took the median of all their priorities, the surprising thing was that they were very, very much in agreement, and that lends at least some credibility to the finalized prioritized list. I'd just like to go through three objections that I hear all the time, so I might as well save you the effort, or at least make our debate a little better. The first one is, why economists? Why on earth did you not ask everyone else? Why not ask a malaria expert when you're talking about malaria? Why not ask a climatologist when you're talking about climate? Those are very, very good people to ask if we want to know about malaria or climate. But as we talked about before, the point is if you want to prioritize between them, you actually need to start saying, sure, we can do good with malaria, sure, we can do good with climate, but the issue is where can we do more good for the same amount of money? And that's exactly what we need economists to try to look at. So that was why we involved economists. It's not to say that natural science is not important. It's incredibly important. But it is to say natural science, in a sense, provide the menu for our democracies to make choices. But for politicians and democracies to make choices, we also need the prices on that menu. And that, I think, was part of what Copenhagen Consensus could help fulfill. The second part was, why only $50 billion? I always get a little surprised when people say only $50 billion. Yeah, it's a pretty big amount of money. But still, we had the somewhat dubious honor of having a counter-conference organized for Copenhagen Consensus, where the head of the UNEP and the Commissioner for Environment and several other very important people showed up. It basically became a place of, or a game of, if you want to say, a game of saying, who can name the biggest number? So people started saying, why not $100 billion? Why not $200 billion? Yeah. The world spends $1,000 billion in arms. Why not $1,000 billion? And our point was really just to say, there's nothing sacred about the $50 billion. We said that because we actually thought it was a reasonably realistic, if somewhat optimistic, assumption that we might be able to get people on board for $50 billion. But certainly the whole point is to say, you just want to say, if you only got $5 billion, you can go a little down the list. If you've got $50 billion, you can go much further down the list. If you have $500 billion, we'd be all pleased about that, but we'd still want to spend it right. And that just simply means you can go even further down the list. The last objection I just want to briefly mention is people very often get sort of flustered about the whole idea of saying, but you're comparing totally different things. You're comparing apples and oranges. But of course, the whole point is that is exactly what economics is about, what prioritization is about. And certainly we do this routinely at the supermarket. We do actually make choices between apples and oranges and don't seem to have much of a quibble between them. We actually do make much, much bigger comparisons between all kinds of different things. Companies do this. National constituencies does this between opera houses and highways and what have you. We do make these kinds of choices, and those are exactly the kind of choices that we have to make when we start talking about prioritization. So I'd actually say, yes, exactly, we are making comparisons between apples and oranges or even much more disparate objects, but that's exactly the essence of trying to talk about prioritization. So I just summarize with one of our experts, Professor Bruno Frey, who I think very briefly pointed out, it's a crazy project, but it's even crazier not to do it. The point is, it is hard in many, many different ways. But I think it's also an important and valid discussion to have. And this was the first stab at it. And that's also one of the reasons why I'm very happy that LSE wanted to give us this opportunity to have the discussion about how should we prioritize. Let me just briefly give you a sense of two of the papers. These are the first two ones. They also turn out to be the top and bottom of the priority list. So it gives you a sense of the proportion of why this actually came out in the way it does. I'm in no way doing justice to the background papers, but again, if we're going to do this, and I'm going to do this in 30 minutes, I have to just be very brief. Basically, on the climate change issue, there's no quibble with the science. Yes, climate change is happening. It will have impacts. It will have most of its impacts in the far future. We're talking about 2100 and after that. The main issue really is, what can we do? Our economists came up with three approaches, which was basically the Kyoto Protocol, carbon taxes, and a precautionary approach, which really just translated into very high carbon taxes. And the main issue was then, how do you deal with a far-off future? And I'm just simply showing you here the result, if you go through the paper, which is basically saying, what would the Kyoto Protocol, for instance, cost? How much would the cost be? And how much would the benefit be? That's a very, very simple thing. Of course, there's a lot of calculation behind this. Goes over the next 300 years. There's a lot of discussion in this. What you basically see in all these three ones is it really depends on what the economists call the discount rate, basically how much do you value the future compared to the present. If you value the future much compared to the present, then it does pay off in all three areas, both the optimal carbon tax, the Kyoto Protocol, and a precautionary approach. If you don't, if you value it more like you'd value most other projects, certainly in national governments, they are all actually net negative benefits. That is, that they do not pay for themselves. And that was also the view that all eight economists took at the end of the day, that that you have to at least compare it with, which is actually a fairly small discount rate compared to what we usually use at 3.5%, then you do actually get that the net benefits are all negative on all three accounts. But that was one of the main issues. I'm sure we'll also have some of the other discussions, but that was the main issue, I think, that the economists had to face up with. If I could just go on to communicable diseases. Likewise, communicable diseases is a huge issue. 90% of all avoidable deaths in the world are caused by communicable diseases. The three things that we can do, Ann Mills from London School of Hygiene and Tropical Diseases came up with control of malaria, control of HIV/AIDS, and strengthening basic healthcare services. And again, what she came up with at the end of the day, and I'm in no way, again, doing justice to this, was basically what are the costs, what are the benefits if you look at malaria. The benefits are pretty high. They're about five times the investment. If you look at control of HIV/AIDS, it's surprisingly, staggeringly high benefits, upwards of 40 times the investment. If you look at scale-up basic health services, they're both very, very costly, and they typically pay back around $2 on the dollar. So for every dollar we invest, we get $2 of social good done in the world. It's important to say all these are social costs. There's nobody who actually expect that we could tax people so that we could actually make a benefit out of this. This is not a sort of investment scheme. It's not like you could go out and invest in malaria or in HIV/AIDS and actually get money back in this. It's not a business course class. But the point here is that it would do social good for every dollar we invest. We'd probably end up doing $40 of good if we invest in control of HIV/AIDS. These were some of the discussions that the experts had to do. And then basically come up with how much do we trust these models. Of course, there are many more models. I'm just showing you the main results of what came out from the different models. Let me just briefly give you a tour through what was actually the list. And just like in Eurovision, I'm going to start from behind. From the bottom, what they did was they organized them in four major categories. They said the bad investments, the investments that actually give less back than what you invest. The fair investments, which are probably $1 to $3 in the dollar, the good investments, and the very good investments, which are obviously the ones that we should start off doing. So if you look at bad projects, I'm not going to comment on all of these issues. It's very obvious that all three climate issues ranged very low, which, of course, caused some consternation. I should also say, though, there's no doubt that no matter what had ended up at the bottom of the list, some people would have gotten angry. That's the nature of prioritizing, that you end up having a lot of people who are annoyed with you because basically you don't say everything should come in first, right? But this was, again, as the economist said, well, we have to prioritize the future equally in all these areas. And when we invest, and clearly do invest, in other areas, prioritizing the present much higher than the future compared to what it would take to care dramatically for climate change, we think that it's reasonable also to say that climate change actually is a fairly bad investment. Most of them said if you invest a dollar, you probably get somewhat around, on the Kyoto Protocol, you probably get perhaps 2 cents back. It's not to say that you didn't do good, but you just didn't do very much good with your extra dollar. And so the issue here is, do we really want to do this first? And the argument I would say from Copenhagen Consensus is, no, this is just simply not the place where we can do the most good first. Let me just show you the FAIR projects. One of the things I'd like to point out is communicable diseases, the scaled up basic health services. It indicates very well what one of the discussions, you saw it before, where they came out and said the benefit was probably 2 to 1, so for every dollar you invest, you get $2 back. But one of the assumptions behind that is that obviously most of these experiments are based on scaled up small pilot projects. And one of the main concerns of the economists was to say, sure, these very, very great pilot projects might actually work in the sense that we end up getting $2 for every dollar we invest. But if you actually did this in all over the developing world, put a nurse in every hamlet in the developing world, what would happen? Well, they were afraid that a lot of these nurses would actually not be nurses, but would be somebody's cousin or something, that there would be a lot of actual corruption involved in this. And so they just thought this made it up to, they were probably more inclined to say that it was probably $1.50 of social good we'd do for every dollar. That's why it came so fairly low down the list. This is actually one of the arguments that many, this is one of the proposals that a lot of aid organizations seem to favor quite heavily. But again, it was seen as fairly low priority from the top economists. Again, if you look at the good projects, a lot of sanitation and water, which surprised me. I've argued very heavily for focusing more on sanitation and water. It's also true that sanitation and water kills a lot of people every year, and it does incapacitate an enormous amount of people. About 500 million people every year get severely ill, and we could do a lot about that by investing in sanitation and clean water. The problem is it also has huge costs. There's actually a lot of piping you have to put in there, and that's why it is a good project, but it's not a great project, simply because it has payoffs in somewhere between $4 and $7 on the dollar. It's a good thing, but there are even better things, and those are the four top things I'd like to just briefly discuss. The fourth best one was control of malaria. Malaria probably causes about 2 billion incidences each year. If we invested about $13 billion over the next 4 years, we could cut that incidence in half. That is, we could avoid 1 billion people from getting infected by malaria each year. It would cost about 500,000 people to avoid dying. But that's probably not even the most important issue here, because the point is that much of the malaria is actually holding back development for most of these countries, simply because a lot of places you have two people hired to do one person's job, simply because you know there's a good chance one of them is going to be sick by malaria at any one time. So if we did something about malaria, it would not just mean that we'd have fewer people dying, but we would have much, much fewer people being incapacitated, being able to better take care of their own lives, therefore improving the economy, and in the long run, of course, being much better able to deal with many of the other issues that are also out there. That's why the fourth best investment is malaria. Third best is investment in free trade and cutting of subsidies, basically acknowledging that if we're going to get this done, we need to bribe first world farmers. And that's the main cost of cutting subsidies. Again, it must be emphasized that the potential benefits are huge. The dynamic models, unlike the World Bank, which quote a fairly conservative estimate of about $300 billion, which is still a huge amount, the dynamic models over the next 50 years show that the average output would be upwards to $2,400 billion extra a year, half of which would accrue to the third world. So it would both benefit the rich world, but it would also benefit the poor world dramatically. And so this was a very good project, again, to invest in, and one that would really pay off to pay off our farmers. The second best, I think, and perhaps in many ways the most surprising one, was control of malnutrition from micronutrients. One of the points that Copenhagen Consensus ends up pointing out in many different ways is that there are many things that we can worry about, but they're not equally good. Most people, when you think about malnutrition, think about lack of calories, which makes sense. Half of all deaths from malnutrition comes from lack of calories. But the other half comes from lack of micronutrients like iron, zinc, iodine, and vitamin A. And actually, 3.5 billion people are estimated to have some sort of micronutrient deficiency. That is more than half the world. But the point is that it's much more expensive to provide calories than to provide essentially a vitamin pill. Now, again, in an ideal world, we'd want to do both. But in a world where we hardly do either, we should ask ourselves, when it's 10 times more efficient to do the micronutrient thing, shouldn't we be more focused on doing micronutrients first? So again, this was where we said about $12 billion we could do huge impact. We'd probably cut the incidence in about half of malnutrition from micronutrients. It would have huge benefits, both directly and indirectly. The top project, again, is perhaps most obvious and also something that we've all heard already about HIV/AIDS. Again, I'd just like to add the little point here to say that it's mainly about prevention of new HIV/AIDS cases. For about $27 billion, we could avoid 28 million new cases over the next 8 years. The idea here is, again, to say it's much cheaper to prevent than to treat. It doesn't mean that in an ideal world we wouldn't want both to treat and to prevent. But there seems to be a great predominance of treatment, simply because these are people we can actually see. However, the cost of treating people, apart from the practical problems that are really huge too, is that it costs about 10 times as much. So again, we have to ask ourselves, in a world where we hardly do both well, we have to ask ourselves, what should we be more preoccupied with, saving one person or saving 10 persons for every time we spend an amount of money? So again, what the Copenhagen Consensus does is it points out that we don't do all good things, which makes most people feel crazy and uneasy. But it also points out there are great things we can do, which I think should advocate that we should be much more focused on actually doing these things, and also that we do have to make priorities because they do get made. Even if we don't have the discussion, it's just unlikely that they'll be as good as we could make them if we actually had the discussion. One of the great obvious points, of course, is to say, is this the right list? If you ask the world's top economists, you inevitably end up asking old white American men. They're not necessarily terribly representative of the world, right? I mean, we had an Indian, we had a Chinese, we had a woman, we had a European. But, you know, it had that feeling to it, right? And so our concern was really, is this the right list? Well, academically, I would argue it is. But it's important also to say, does it resonate with people? So we invited 80 young people from all over the world. The only two requirements were they had to be college students, so that they could understand and partake in this discussion, and they had to speak English because we couldn't afford the translation. And there were also some other considerations, you know, could they fly to Copenhagen, that kind of stuff. But the basic point was we actually got a broad representative outcome from all over the world, 75% from developing countries, and they basically met up with all the same experts. They quizzed them all the same, but we didn't ask them to come up with an economic prioritization. At the end of the day, they had to make what they found to be the most reasonable prioritization. They were not economists. They weren't even predominantly social scientists. They were mostly from natural science and art, the arts. Is that what it's called? Yeah. So the idea here is, again, to say that we actually had a very broad discussion in this, and this was an open discussion. The surprising thing is that the list is in many ways strikingly similar. Malnutrition and diseases are at top, climate change at the bottom. And this was even true when we analyzed the results for developing world. Even the developed world university students seemed to prioritize, for instance, climate very, very far down, which was very surprising, even from the students from Seattle, which you would have imagined would be different. But the idea here is to say that this does indicate, at least to me, that we have something that has some value. It's not to say that this is the perfect list, and that's important to say, but it is to say that the broad ranking of that list is probably not terribly far off. It's important to say if the discussion was, is the benefit-cost ratio 4.1 or 4.2, I'd worry. We'd probably not be right. But that's not the discussion that we have. It really is it 40-1 or is it 1-40? And that I feel much more comfortable about. So the debate I see ahead is really very much about sensitizing people to this discussion, having our arguments about what do you want? What is the more important thing to do first? It's also to start saying, this is a research agenda. There are some things that you might have noticed that are not there. For instance, education, conflicts, financial instability. For instance, education. I thought education would be a shoe-in. What the experts told us, the education experts told us, was it's not about providing more money for school books or better schools. It's about structural change. And then, of course, the experts said, well, how do you do that? They said, we don't know. But if we don't know how to solve education, we shouldn't put it on the top of our priority list. Now, notice this is not the same thing as saying that we don't want to do something about education, but it's just to say, when we don't know how to do it, let's do other things that we actually do know how to solve. But one of the things I'm hoping, and that's also one of the messages I'd like to bring here today, is, of course, that there are going to be bright PhD students out there who are going to say, I want to be the guy who plucks that hole. I want to actually be the person who comes up with a great strategy of how we might get education on the board. Likewise, with the bottom priorities like climate change, one of the things I'm hoping that this stimulates is to say, well, maybe Kyoto Protocol is a bad way of investing, but it doesn't mean climate change is not a good thing to do something about. Maybe there are smart ways to deal with climate change. One of the things I think would be a smart way to deal with is to invest in research and development on renewables, or really just research and development in non-carbon emitting energy technologies. If we could do that, if we could come up with smart ways to deal with that, we can actually redo Copenhagen Consensus in 2008, then 2012, and so on. So what we actually see is, hopefully, a path forward where we deal with some of the top priorities. They'll fall down. We get other top priorities. We also get smarter ways to deal with the things we don't know about, and we get smarter ways to deal with the things that came down the bottom. That would be a great social process. And perhaps also, importantly, we also get new knowledge infused into this whole discussion so that we actually get a better priority list every time. So this was the first time. It's not a perfect list, but it certainly is a start. I'll just briefly mention some of the other things that we're trying to do. We have many, many projects. This is not the same thing as saying that these are all going to happen. But trying to get people to think about priorities in many different ways. We're trying to get the G8 interested. We're trying to do, for instance, Latin America. Say, okay, Latin America might not be, obviously most of the good investments in the world is in sub-Saharan Africa. Latin America is not perhaps the obvious candidate. But if you were to do something in Latin America, where should you invest first? That would probably be very different issues. But it's important for Latin America. It's certainly important for many of the organizations that are predominantly focused on Latin America. So we're working with the Inter-American Development Bank and doing a Latin American Copenhagen consensus. For individual countries, for instance, the Millennium Challenge account is somewhat concerned about the fact that that's a Bush $5 billion proposal and saying if countries fulfill certain requirements, they'll get money. But of course, what should you then spend the money on? There's a certain concern that there's no given on how you should do that. Maybe you'd want to do a prioritized list for Lesotho and then go in and say, well, what should you spend your money on first? So at least you get a tendency to pick from the top of the priority list rather than the bottom. We're trying to do this with the UN. We're trying to do it with the UN ambassadors next year. We're trying to do this in the World Bank. The World Bank does lots of good things, but it probably does a lot of fairly bad things too. It might be a good idea to get a list of what does it do very good and what doesn't it do so well. Maybe we should do more of the very good things. We're actually working with the European Environment Agency. We're also working with the American Environment Protection Agency to start and say, what about if we did a prioritization of Europe's environment? Notice this is a totally different kind of thing. But we're basically saying, we'd love all to have more environment in Europe. But say you had 10 billion extra euros to do good in Europe's environment. What would you do first? Do you want more clean water, clean air, maybe more forest? But you can't have it all. What do you want first? It's a great way to start getting people to think about this. So those are the kind of paths I'm seeing ahead, and then I'll shut up. Basically, I think this whole discussion is about triage. It's about saying, in a world where we don't do everything, let's not do stuff we don't know how to do, like education. Let's not do stuff where we can spend a lot of money and doing very little good, like climate change. But let's start doing things where we can do an immense amount of good right now and would do a lot of good also to make the world better able to deal with the problems that anyway will come down the path. But also to make and start a process where we start deliberating what should our priorities be so we don't just have them happen because we've discussed about individual issues but never across all these issues, but we actually have a discussion about what should be the best priorities for the world. And that's why I think it's great that you've showed up here today. I'm looking very much forward to having that discussion with you. Thank you.
I'm going to invite Mark Maslin to speak first.
I have to say, it's always fascinated me listening to engaging and charming speakers, particularly such a person as Professor Longberg, because for a brief moment there, you almost agree. And unfortunately, I don't. So what I'm going to try to do is to throw out a few ideas to stimulate the debate and get your questions going. The first one I thought I'd start with is the 50 billion. According to Professor Longberg, this is a lot of money. Well, is it? I mean, that's roughly 10 billion a year he's talking about spending. The US Millennium Challenge account, which he's mentioned, is actually 5 billion a year alone. Admittedly, they haven't started spending it yet. So in real terms, 10 billion a year is about 0.03% of what we as OECD countries earn. So that doesn't seem very much. And the way I actually explain this to my students is I say, imagine that I am the OECD. Okay? My salary is the total. And my six-year-old daughter, who's already nagging me for pocket money, comes up to me and says, I want some pocket money. I've read the Copenhagen Consensus, and I want that money. I go, okay. So, of course, I worked out that was about 20p per week. This raises two major problems. One, my students worked out how poorly academics are paid, so so I think some of them are going to be leaving and becoming real economists. And the second thing is, I realised that actually I have 71 children, because there's 71 countries by the UN that have been identified by the UN who need that development money. So that 20p then has to be spread around those 71 people. So this is my first objection, because I don't believe that economists should be used as accountants. I don't believe you should give them a lump of money and say, how are you going to prioritise that? How are you going to use that? That really is accountancy. It's not what economists should be there to do. Economists should be firstly defining world problems, which they have done for the Copenhagen consensus. But what they should then be doing is look at solutions to those problems, however large they are and however much they cost. They should say, how do we solve those problems? Forget about having realism or absolute cost. How do we solve those problems? And then what they need to do as economists is provide a means that the world and the world economy can actually provide those answers. An example is the Monterey Consensus, and I put this in brackets, a real consensus, suggested that about 0.7% of GDP of OECD countries should be used. Now that's about 210 billion per year, about 14 times the amount the Copenhagen consensus. So that's just to open that debate about how much should the world really be spending on solving the world problems. The second objective is the word consensus. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been working on global warming and climate change for the last 15 years. The last report was over 2,600 pages long. Admittedly, the politicians, I think, just read the two pages of executive summary. The 2001 report had 400 experts from 120 countries, which I think is the most important point there. And 250 experts reviewed their findings. And the IPCC really wouldn't use the word consensus unless they were really forced to. But we have the Copenhagen consensus. In contrast, 30 experts, many of them white, old males. Oh, they do have Nobel Prizes, because they had a good idea in the 60s. And then we have the 80s Dream Team, which I have to admit, and you may have seen some reports, may have been slightly self-selecting due to Professor Longberg's wonderful reputation. So I would suggest this is hardly a world consensus. But it's great PR. My third one is climate change. Now, I have to say, I'm not going to spend too long on this, because Julian will be speaking more on this, I'm sure. But everyone acts like a frightened rabbit in the headlights when it comes to climate change, because it impacts on everything we do. It really gets the fundamental of our global economy, oil. But we have to deal with this, because the key thing is that it's a feedback loop. We want to deal with global poverty, so we should develop the world. One of the key things with development is we produce industries, produce more pollution, accelerate global warming, cause more problems. Climate change also causes more extreme events. And there's a very clear link between the Human Development Index and mortality due to massive climate change impacts such as hurricanes. A classic example is a whole American US city gets wiped out, New Orleans, and about 1,500 people die. Now that's a large number of people. Similar hurricane, 1998, hits Honduras, kills over 20,000 people, 2.5 million people homeless, and sets back Honduras about 10 years of development. Similar size hurricane, different infrastructure. So lots of people believe that 2 degrees is the cutoff point. Before 2 degrees, and I think there is a consensus, if I dare use that word, that there will be winners and losers in the world, climate change up to 2 degrees. After 2 degrees, everybody loses. But poor people lose a little bit more than everybody else. So there's a double or triple hit on the developing world, the world that we're actually trying to help in that way. So climate change needs to be dealt with. And the estimates by economists, so I have to put my hand on heart and say, they're economists, so we must trust them, 5% of GDP could it cost if we go above the 2 degrees C's in the developing world. So, to conclude, as I'm only allowed 15 minutes and then I'm going to be kicked off, 10 billion is really, per year, an accountancy exercise. But what we should be doing is changing the way the world thinks about money and how money is redistributed around the world. It's called social justice. And the thing is, we're already doing that. The EU have targets that by 2010, 0.56 of our GDP will be spent on overseas aid. By 2015, if the politicians keep their view, it'll be about 0.7. Denmark has already given 0.84 and has done for the last 10 years. So it's quite possible without damaging your economy. Copenhagen consensus isn't necessarily a world consensus, and I believe that climate change needs to be dealt with and is one of the priorities. And I give you one very little example, is that the USA and the UK, in economic terms, GDP growth over the last 15 years has been very similar. But for some reason, the UK CO2 emissions by you lot has actually been dropping, whereas in the US, they've increased by a third. I'll leave you with that. Thank you.
And finally, Lord Hunt.
Good evening. It's always nice to come to another college in London, and we collaborate between UCL and LSE in this Lytle Institute of Mathematical Sciences and many other projects. My experience touches on many of the things talked about by Bjørn Lomborg, which I thought was a very interesting and stimulating talk, and I agree with some of it, and I disagree with some of it as well. I was head of the Met Office, where I had to learn and got very interested in sort of broader meteorological and climatological issues. I'd formerly, before being a scientist, who only was concerned with the bottom kilometer of the atmosphere. Since then, I've become a Tony crony in the House of Lords with your ex-director, Tony Giddens. And of course, as Richard Layard has also down the road, by the way, who was very impressed with Bjørn Lomborg's evidence to the House of Lords committee on climate change, and he said the House of Lords committee was quite impressed, but he said he agreed with the science. They weren't expecting that, so it shows that they hadn't been reading his works properly. But they don't always read things properly, as you probably know. But last week I was in Africa because I'm chairman of a non-governmental organisation called ACOP, set up by Lord Callaghan, which focuses on the marine areas, and we was looking at coastal zones in Africa. And so I was actually had a tour. You could say a rather sort of sobering tour of very, very poor areas in the town of Accra on the coast there, and seeing and being presented, you know, with the whole difficulties of just the things being talked about by Professor Lomborg: shortage of water, disease, and particularly affecting elderly people in the city of Accra. The number one disease of people entering the outpatients, as was explained to us at this meeting we helped organise, is malaria. And number two, quite close behind, is in fact respiratory diseases associated with burning, air pollution, and so on. Which brings me to my point, really, a fundamental point, that I think there's a philosophical approach that Bjorn has been taking this afternoon is that we can look at all these kind of priorities and then we can have policies associated with those. But supposing, in fact, the environment and indeed our urban civilization is in fact holistic in every possible way, then that dialectic begins to fall apart, because you actually got to say, well, if I do one thing, it's going to affect the other thing, and therefore I must choose the best optimum solution which brings all these points together. That, of course, was in the natural world, was the great inspiration of Lovelock, who introduced the idea of Gaia. The fact is that the world's actual chemical constituents emerge at the same time as the biological systems. It isn't a set of independent variables. We now know that if you want to do a practical solution in a town for your water, your electricity, your air pollution, it's all got to be holistic. And therefore, simply by trying to say, well, am I going to have clean water in this town more than air or whatever, it actually may lead you into false dichotomies. So my sort of answer to this question is also to the question of this rather powerful graph. I don't know, did you present it? I didn't see it. I was showing that the Kyoto Protocol would have a minimal impact on air pollution. And indeed, that's true. Kyoto Protocol produces 10 or 20%. I think it's very small. The Royal Commission on Environmental Pollution in Britain has said that if we're actually going to make our contribution in the UK to really stop the rise in global temperature, we must reduce our carbon emissions by 60%. And they gave the figure of 60% by 2050. For the United States to make an equitable reduction, it would have to reduce its by 80%. Now, of course, the argument is, does this have a bad effect on the economy? Well, the Treasury's estimation was that this would only have an effect of something between 1 and 1.5% impact on our GDP. So this notion that having a big reduction of carbon would have a big impact on it was, our Treasury people are not natural sort of greenies. So for them, and they probably were all trained here, so I think that's quite persuasive. I think an even more persuasive one, I don't know how many people here live in Woking. Anybody live in Woking? Sort of place, it's quite near London. But this is actually now a world famous example, because the borough energy official in Woking, a man called Alan Jones, I don't really know about him, but he in 1989 read the famous report by Mrs. Brundtland, the Prime Minister of Norway, you remember, who was very impressed by climate change issues. And also she really introduced the notion of sustainable development at a sort of global governmental level. So Alan Jones, and this is evidence he gave to the House of Lords Committee on Climate Change, and he's spoken around it, and now he's now been promoted up to running climate change in London. Anyway, he went back to Woking and said to the borough, there, give me £250,000 and I will invest it in energy saving and associated technology, but you must allow me every time I make savings to reinvest it. So he had a sinking fund, and over the 15 years from 1990 to 2005 or four, he reduced the energy supply of all the buildings and all the operations of the borough of Woking. So that's the offices, the swimming pools, the public lavatories, but also the old people's houses, libraries, everything, by 45%. He reduced the carbon emissions of Woking by 70%. So he met the 2050 target, you know, in 2003. So how did he do this? Well, he borrowed some money from Denmark, and we're very grateful. And this has caused great consternation in Whitehall that Woking had to go to Denmark to save the world. But the other thing that has really caused consternation in the DCI is he went off the grid. He rewired Woking, because in fact on the grid, if you make electricity in one part, they'll give you about 1p a unit, and then you go down the road and say, I'd like that my electricity out of the wire again, please, and they'll say, oh, that'll be 5p a unit. So if you actually want to have an integrated system, you have your own grid, which you did. And so in 2003, in the summer, when all the lights went out in London, that power cut, I don't know whether it went out here, but I think I was just around the corner in Covent Garden, all the lights went out. In Woking, the lights stayed on. But there are other places around the world, Curitiba and so on. I think that the point is, and to come back to those houses and in these terribly deprived and stressed communities, but there are people are coming into those communities just for as the reasons Lomborg recognises, for jobs and so on, and people will come for jobs even though the environment is terrible, even though the health may be terrible, but I believe that as it were a holistic technological and environmental approach will be the solution. I believe before long there are people in Cambridge who are going to have a plastic that you'll be able to put on your roof, you'll be able to get your electricity from your roof that will enable you to clean your water, it'll also enable you to process the sewage that you create. This will enable people already, of course these people maybe in these areas, but they're buying their televisions and so on the internet. And the people will be able to participate, and it will also be easier for these communities to develop. One of the interesting points to go back to Woking was that this success actually led to a greater public participation in that area, both public recognition of these issues, than anywhere else in the UK. So I think that we do need, the holistic approach. I mean, the kind of approach that's adopted, if I may say so, by our department, our DFID, for looking at these issues around the world is poverty reduction. And I think they focus on that in an excessively narrow way. They haven't recognized that, in fact, perhaps sometimes the best way of poverty reduction is to look at this in a more holistic way, which involves all these techniques. I think there has been a change of heart in DFID since since Mrs. Short left. I find talking to her very difficult. Head of the Met Office talks to, ex-head of the Met Office talks to head of DFID. It was a non-conversation. But nevertheless, I mean, I give a lot of credit to her for focusing on poverty and that social dimension. I mean, she changed a lot of the way we do things, but I think the pendulum's got to swing back, and we need to think along the lines that I have been mentioning. So I just think this is a slightly different kind of intellectual policy approach, and that one of the things one knows is it's much easier in Whitehall or in governments to actually say, let's be holistic. Even that's quite difficult, to actually say, well, I'm going to give your money to Ministry A and give less to Ministry B and less to Ministry C in a very harsh kind of way is exceedingly difficult, which indeed Professor Lomborg, I think, was admitting. But maybe there's a way in the Copenhagen Consensus and the Tufnell Park process I just talked about could work together.
Yeah, I've just been allowed to comment some really briefly. I'd just like to say thank you for both of your comments. I'd say, sure, if somebody wants to give us the money to become 2,000 people at the IPC, I'm all happy about that, but I think it was pretty good we got the 38 people together, and they were pretty good. With the self-selection, we tried hard. I have no idea whether that's, we're presenting it as it is, and again, I would be all happy if we tried to do it even better. I'm not saying this is the list, but I'm saying it's certainly interesting that this is the first time we've actually tried to do a list. I'll attach three serious comments. One of them was the idea that if we get above 2 degrees centigrade, then everybody starts losing. I think that's probably about correct. I think it might also be very correct that we'll have 5% GDP loss. The point, though, here is to say you have to remember that it's the margin we're talking about. It's how much you can do about that. Because even if we did a lot of, for instance, Kyoto, what even might be possible to do, we will still have to have a lot of the issues. It might still be 4.8% GDP loss. So the question is, how much are we willing to spend on avoiding the 0.2% GDP loss? That's the correct discussion, and that, I think, we need to have that discussion.
Can I just say that the point is our Treasury didn't... It's 60%.
Yes.
Lower figure than
I'll,
that.
I'll get to you. No, I was talking about Mark's figure. I'm sorry. I'm treating you in sequence here. The last thing is you were saying that we're spending 0.84% of our means in Denmark to do good. I'm all for it. To say that we should be spending much more. I'm not saying that the $50 billion is the right figure. I'm still, though, saying that we should spend it right. We want to spend it in the best possible way. So it's still back to the discussion about the priorities. About Julian's two points, I would just simply say, you mentioned that malaria was first and then air pollution. I actually think that's right. It's one of the things I really regret that we couldn't have in the Copenhagen Consensus. But it's perhaps important to say, and most people don't are not aware of this, that the most important environmental problem in the world is undoubtedly indoor air pollution. The WHO estimate that 2.8 million people, almost the same amount of people that die from HIV/AIDS, die from indoor air pollution, mainly in the third world. Why? Because they use cow dung and cardboard and whatever they can find to cook and heat indoor. Of course, the solution here is not to environmentally certify dung, but to start thinking about making them sufficiently rich that they can afford kerosene. So again, one of the things I think is by making them not sick from malaria, by making not sick from HIV/AIDS, by making not weak by malnutrition and allowing them into our markets, we enable them to get so rich that they can actually start solving some of those problems. So again, it's a question of what can we do. The last bit about the holistic thing, I'd also just like, you've said the impact of GDP is only a 1.6% GDP cut. That's true, but you just got to remember that virtually anything we want to do in this world, the UN actually estimate that we could solve all major basic problems in the world for about $75 billion a year. We could give clean drinking water, sanitation, basic health care, and education to everyone in the world. It's true that a lot of things are fairly cheap. So yes, we can solve a lot of problems, but we don't. So I still think as long as we don't solve all problems, we really do have to start prioritizing. And the problem with the holistic approach, it seems to me, is a little bit, it's saying, yeah, let's both do good things and slightly less good things. It's a little bit like saying, I'm not saying that it is the same thing, but you know, when Marie Antoinette said, let them eat cake. If people come up and say, well, maybe cake is not such a good thing, maybe we should give them bread instead because it's much more cost efficient. It's a little bit like saying, okay, let them both have cake and bread. You know, it doesn't make the cake part a smart idea. If we say let's both invest in things that are smart and things that are less smart, I would still argue let's not invest in less smart things before we've exhausted all the smartest things.
I'm going to open to general questions, and I'm sure there'll be a long queue, but we're going to start back there. Wait for the microphone, please.
Okay. This being the LSE, I feel there should be an economic question. And I really want to ask on behalf of all the economists in the room, which is this. I was one, by way of interaction, I was one who, when I first heard you speak, something like 2 years ago, was stimulated and interested. And then I started looking at the work. When I looked at the work from a methodological point of view, I discovered that really it was manipulative, methodologically a disaster, and simply designed to get headlines. And I started rather sympathetic. The reason for this is that if you actually look at global crises, global solutions, which no one in this room would have read because it's unreadable, you will discover that the only paper on climate change, pro, was by a very well-known trade economist, William Klein, who wrote a book called The Economics of Global Warming, which is coming up with a specific solution based on high carbon taxes in the next 4 years. And he was rebutted by two other American economists, Mendelsohn and Mann, who've done a lot of work. Out of that, the experts chose to condemn this solution as a bad one. Now, this was nothing to do with the idea that climate change, responding to, was a bad investment. But of course, as you knew, all the media headlines said responding to climate change was a bad investment. And my specific question, given that your operation was partly co-sponsored by The Economist magazine, was why, who also publicized it, why in the 5th of February issue were the two very interesting quotations, one from Thomas Schelling, the Nobel Prize winner and expert, who said, according to The Economist, presenting climate change at the bottom of the list as bad is misleading. And a second quotation from Robert Mendelsohn, one of the key discussants and opponents, an American economist, who said he worried that climate change was set up to fail. Would you like to respond to those points?
Yes. We had a long discussion about the first the quote from Thomas Schelling, who was very concerned about the whole idea of talking about things that were not above the $1. He also, and you can read his, he has his own statement in the book. He said that it was a bad investment, but he felt that it should not have been on the list, because it was not a good investment, and therefore it should not be used. The other economists, and I frankly also disagree with that discussion. I think it is a public discussion whether that should whether it should be a good investment or not. But he's obviously free to have his opinion on that on that idea. But he's saying that it should not be on the list because it's not on the list of what we should do. He felt that it should stop at the fair level, and that we should not have made a bottom one. We should just simply have left out global warming. I think that's wrong and incorrect, but that's a discussion about basically how do you communicate the results. Mendelsohn was concerned afterwards that it was being used, and that's a fair concern, that it was being used to just simply say there is nothing that can be used about global warming. It is important to say that all the experts say that much lower carbon taxes, for instance, carbon taxes of $1 or $2 would probably have been favorable. They would have been nowhere near malaria, but they would probably have been good investments. And as most economists, you would know, they would actually like of carbon taxes. It is an externality. The whole discussion in the panel revolved around $1 or $2. Is that actually going to be so little that it will cost more to administer the taxes? And that was why, and nobody was able to come up with modeling at the forum, and that was why they decided just simply to say that might be a good investment, and certainly we should also invest more in research and development. The setup of the Copenhagen Consensus was very much one where we asked the chief people who were responsible of the individual chapters to come up with the solutions. We figured that was the best way of trying to do this. This is one of the places where you can't win. Had I asked Nordhaus to do, who has clearly come out and said Kyoto is a bad thing, I would have been lambasted for picking him. Now, I picked actually one of the guys who've argued that climate change is one of the things we should do. But of course, what he also did, and perhaps looking back in retrospect, I should have forced him to come up with a much less invasive proposal, one that's much, much less than Kyoto. But he did Kyoto and something more than Kyoto, because he is that kind of public advocacy type. I would imagine that most people in the global warming community would have come up with the same Kyoto or more. And those were rejected by the economists. Now, had they come out with much, much less than Kyoto, maybe they would actually have accepted that as a fair, not a good, not a very good, but a fair proposal. But the problem here is to say, is that really invalidating of Copenhagen consensus? No, I think that the whole discussion is it Kyoto or is it more than Kyoto? It's not whether it's less than Kyoto, but it is certainly one of the things that we're going to have in 2008. The last bit about that it's unreadable, I mean, I'm sorry you think so. A lot of people actually seem to disagree with you. Most people are actually very complimentary about the great overview that these economists brought to bear. It's certainly also been a book that has been widely sold to all universities around the planet. But you know, you're of course entitled to that view, but I would say still I think it is important to say we need this discussion, and saying you don't like it, I would, you know, at least invite you to come up with saying, well, what else should we do?
Okay. Next question here. The lady in the back. Yes, please. Yes.
I see that the consensus list included population migration. Was there any discussion at any point about population control?
Yes, there was a large discussion, and this again is one of the problems of saying one of the things we want to do for 2008 is that we actually want to do sort of a small Copenhagen consensus, back of the envelope kind of discussions on all issues before we whittled them down for practical reasons. This was one of the things where it was felt by most of the economists that there's very little that we can do with money. It's important to say Copenhagen consensus is about what can we do about the world's problem with money. Now, we do know how to do something, for instance, about HIV/AIDS. It's very little that we do know that we can do about population with money. And also, it's seen by most economists as almost neutral in the sense of economic growth when we're talking about the population increase that we see now. So it was discussed. It turned into more of a migration issue, and at the end of that day, it turned out to be a pretty murky one. It was not one I was particularly happy with. Again, when you have this kind of process, it's not everything that you think runs equally smoothly, and certainly one of the things we're also looking forward to is to get this working much better, in the sense that we'll have better lead time, we'll have the experts interacting with the Nobels so that they can ask better questions, so that we could also solve this kind of question as you raised. One of the things I would like to have seen them say is to say to Bill Klein, say we want a proposal that's going to be much less than Kyoto, then he would have made it, and then they could actually have voted on it. So it's one of those things where, you know, you do it the first time, not everything works.
Okay, Mark will comment briefly, and Julian.
I think one of the curious kind of dogs that didn't bark in the night about climate change is the question of population. When I entered the sort of Whitehall world, head of the Met Office in the early 90s, I noticed we talked about climate change, we never talked about population. What was the world's population going to be? And I was told that Mrs. Thatcher and President Reagan didn't like us to talk about that. And the effect had continued. And I think, but seriously, I mean, population policy or population predictions have an enormous impact on the whole change. I mean, many people believe that the rate of increase is now as it were, reduced the world's population. We may well see a world maximum population in 2100, 2150. This will have an enormous impact on the whole climate change scenario. And therefore, as again, it's a holistic question. If you have policies about population, for example, it would have an enormous impact on the whole issues of climate change. And I believe that's one of the things one needs to try to not be afraid of discussing.
I think this also touches on a politically sensitive subject, which is governance, because Professor Longberg has picked up on this, and so has the Copenhagen Consensus, that one of the things is that you can give money, you can do things, but if the country is not going to be governed well, then things aren't going to change. And I think this is one of the interesting things. You said it's only about money, but one of the, whether you agree or not, one of the fundamentals of the Millennium Challenge account in the US is that a country has to be governed well before they will invest. So it's the sort of the carrot approach, which is if you have a good governance system, you are going to look after your people, you can have a load of money when they spend it. Yeah.
The next question is from upstairs, extreme left-hand side.
It's coming.
Thank you. I mean, though I'm from the, of course, I'm in the back, I'm really from the backward country when compared to your Scandinavia. I'm good to see you listen to a lecturer from Scandinavian who coincided with the day of election in Sri Lanka. Thanks for your peace operation there. The issue, Professor John Lomberg, is not only money, it's more than money, it's greed. I mean, your civilized Western leaders don't want to share the global resources equally, I mean, fairly. More than two-thirds of the population, I mean, as far as the Europe is concerned, the white-collar man, ill-gotten resources, more than two-thirds of the global population is in the poor country. So one way of tackling this issue is to make this world as a flat world, I mean, borderless world, so that with your money, of course, you can cure malaria or eradicate HIV. But we do have some knowledge. I mean, with our own holistic or traditional views, we can solve your single family issues. We can solve your teenage pregnancy, Whitehall, hello. And we can solve your drug abuse, I mean alcohol abuse, so that the whole world will be a better world. Okay, so break these barriers. You can come to my country. If I'm a millionaire or a people settler only, I can come to your country. So break this barrier. It is not the Berlin Wall or it's not the wall in the Gaza. There is an invisible wall between the you, the greedy rich world, and my poor world. Okay, regards.
And upstairs, yeah, that's right, yes.
Professor Lomberg, when you published your Skeptical Environmentalist, many prominent NGOs used various things to criticize you with, and one of the familiar criticisms was that actually you're not really that knowledgeable of environmental science or environmental dynamics, but instead was simply a number cruncher. Now, listening to you tonight, I have to admit that I am still left with the impression that you are just a number cruncher. And it's not just about the environmental issues, it's also about the policy processes as well. Specifically, you talk about your various subjects which might be up for prioritization. But these subjects are things like climate change and malnutrition, for example. But both of these are highly complex things which are experienced in all sorts of diverse ways. They cannot simply just be reduced down into one simple label, which presumably can attract all sorts of various policy approaches. Similarly, on the policy side, you talk about Kyoto. Now, I don't know anyone who was negotiating Kyoto who thought for 1 second that the target agreed in 1997, which was 5.2% for all the countries involved, was in any way the only thing on the table. And that actually the 5.2% agreement was always intended to be increased and developed over time. And indeed, many of the mechanisms associated with Kyoto were also hoped, perhaps optimistically, to also provide other developmental impacts which weren't necessarily specified in terms of hard targets. Now, my problem is that I agree with you that I think there is a great need for critical analysis of where environmental policy is going. And analysis is needed. However, I feel that the number-crunching approach that you've done here, simply giving us a choice of different labels of problems and a choice of different labels of policy approaches, is simply far too simplistic and doesn't actually help us achieve that. But moreover, I rather suspect that these are leading towards the legitimization of certain policy approaches which actually have a much more normative basis than you're coming clean about. In particular, it seems to me you're very keen on rubbishing political approaches to solutions, such as, for example, Kyoto, and instead very keen on proposing neoliberal kinds of solutions to problems such as market liberalization, reduction of subsidies, etc., etc. So essentially my point is that the methodology is far, far too simple.
First off, on the number cruncher thing, you're absolutely right. I'm not an economist. I'm not a development economist. I'm not an environmentalist. I try to bring in what I think is a necessary discussion into this debate. And I think the question that you have to face is, in a certain sense, to say, I fully agree with you. I hope I also said that several times, that this is simplistic, what I'm presenting up here. I'm not doing full justice to this. I've read the papers, but obviously these people who've actually written the papers know much, much more about this. But at the end of the day, it's you and I, it's policymakers, people from House of Lords who don't read everything, who actually end up having to make these kinds of decisions. And I think it is crucial. No, I was just pointing out your own. I hope nobody took that as a jibe or anything. But the whole point here is to say, at the end of the day, we have to make decisions on probably fairly sketchy information. I think that there is a value in trying to give more beef to that discussion. And right now what we see is very much every area for itself advocating. You know, the malaria guys are saying, do something more about malaria. The climate guys are saying, do something more for climate, and so on. And who wins, very easily could be argued, is the ones with the more sexy pictures. I've always argued that when Paul Emmerich made the movie The Day After Tomorrow, it looks great on TV, but it's unlikely that he's going to, you know, cast Brad Pitt digging latrines in Tanzania in his next movie, right? It just doesn't seem as sexy, but it might be just as important for the world to know. So I think there is a point in trying to get this out. You're saying about the Kyoto Protocol that was also always intended to be more. I fully recognize that point, but at the end of the day, we actually both analyzed what will Kyoto in itself do and what would much stronger criteria do, and it actually turns out that they're even more negative, they're even worse deals. So we do actually deal with both of those issues. So what you're saying is it doesn't lead to success. I would actually beg to differ. I think what we're actually showing is that there's huge amounts of things that can be done that are incredibly cheap and that would work very, very well. I think telling people not only we're going to spend more of your money doing good in the world, but telling people we're going to spend more of your money doing the best we possibly can in the world, and that's really great, is more likely to gain political acceptance. The last bit, why on earth is it, I can only say that you're simply wrong. I mean, you're again entitled to your view on what I'm trying to do, but I don't see, you know, providing condoms as particularly providing of the Bush agenda. I don't see the fact that the three of the four top things are actually things that are very invasive in that sense. We are talking about sending mosquito nets, sending changing the diet and changing the way you have sex in most of the developed world. That seems to me to be fairly sensible and very, very invasive. But the last bit, yes, we are also talking about free trade, but I think most organizations and even Oxfam will acknowledge that if we could lower subsidies to first world farmers, we would do immense amounts of good for third world people.
Okay, the fourth row upstairs, eight seats in.
That's him.
Yes?
Yeah.
Education may not be such a sexy thing, but education is the most potent, instrument of change and betterment. I mean, you also concede education is the best investment, but because we do not know how to, what you call, educate. So you have not taken up that problem. Have you thought of investing the money or investing what you call resources in getting to know how best to educate? And what will be the marginal utility of that investment? Thank you.
Yep. Good point. Bottom line is that that's exactly one of the things we hope to do with 2008, that we want people to, we will basically allow everyone, NGOs, everyone, to send in suggestions as to, you know, short, you know, one-page research ideas of why they should look at this model, or published results that actually show that this would pay off, not just in education, but in any area. But there's also a secondary approach, which is the whole idea of, would more research in all of these areas, would that be beneficial? I think there's a tendency in all university settings, and my personal intuition would be to say, yeah, hell, give us more money, and we, you know, we'll come up with smarter solutions. The problem is that the right focus for the Copenhagen consensus to come out and say, oh, by the way, you should spend $500 million also on each of these areas? Also, we have fairly bad models of what is the payback on research and development. So I'm not sure that that's what we want to do, but by creating a place where we actually showcase the best things that the world can do, I'm hoping that we will also engage individual research and research teams in making up better proposals for smarter use of the money.
Right. Thank you. Mr. Lundberg, just to start with one of your slides, you said, why did we choose economists? Now, I study here, and my apologies to all the economists, but the economists actually, they're good at prioritizing scarce resource, but the problem is they assume things. They assume, I just like perfect rationality, free movement of labor, no transaction cost, perfect information. That's quite ironic in this argument. But they don't look at all at issue linkage. And I just tried to jot down, and my sheet of paper is a mess because there's arrows everywhere. I mean, education impacts malnutrition, it impacts disease, community, and that's also impacted by sanitation and water. Conflict impacts migration and impacts corruption. I mean, don't get me started on the free trade, because that's not the Copenhagen consensus, that's the Washington consensus. So, and you push this logic to the country, like to which country you choose first. I mean, have you heard of political instability if you like help one a lot versus another? So if you were just prioritizing, I could have helped you in the computer lab, show you how Excel works. And if you don't want to learn Excel, they say that statisticians don't have enough charms to be accountants. Well, I think you have enough charm to be an accountant and to do it all by yourself.
Yeah. I'll assume some of the points were rhetoric, but I agree with you that yes, economists make a lot of assumptions. I would, however, say when you make decisions, or when any of us make decisions, how much do we know? You may be an exception. I'm allowed to jab a little bit back at you. Hey, but most of us actually have very little knowledge of most of these things, right? Most of us who have to make choices between very many different issues have headline news. You know, we have perhaps two or three articles that we've read about these different issues. It's certainly not that we know all of it. So my question really here is to say, when we look at how to deal with the world's problems, what these guys tried to do was to use the best economic models that we have for costs and benefits. Now, there's no doubt that those are not the perfect models. They do not include everything. One of the things I'm hoping is that we actually, by making these kinds of progress in Copenhagen consensus, we're forcing people to put in more of the intricacies and the interrelations as you were talking about. But the question still remains is, do we really believe that our intuition is better than the best models that we have out there? So my point is simply not to say Copenhagen consensus is not about making the right choices. It's about using all the knowledge that we already have. It's not about being smarter than we are, but it's just about not being more stupid than we have to be. It's about using the knowledge that we already have. When you talk about that they use perfect information, that's obviously not true. I mean, one of the points I tried to point out was that they actually did look at, is it likely if we put a nurse in every village that they will actually all be nurses, or will there be a lot of corruption? They did take a look at those assumptions that were behind the study and apply critical thinking. Now, it's not the same thing as saying that they figured all of these areas. I mean, no doubt they didn't. But I'm saying it's the best first go that we have. Likewise, I didn't mention that Professor North, who's actually got the Nobel Prize for Institutional Economics and actually looking at a lot of these barriers that lie in the sort of standard framework from economics, were one of the participants. He's together with Schelling and Arrow, just started last week, I was in St. Louis, helping them to look at a new research project, look at the obstacles for implementation of the Copenhagen consensus, policies. Clearly, there's a lot of things we don't know. Clearly, there's a lot of things we need to know better. But the argument still comes back to saying, we have to make choices. We are making a financial decision in 2006 on what we're spending our money on, where we're investing that. We can't postpone that till 2020 when we've decided all the relevant issues. We have to use today's information. I think we did a good job in trying to pull as much of that information together. It's not perfect. But again, I don't think there's much better out there. And that's why I think it really is necessary to have this discussion, and it is necessary to listen to what they at least have come up with in the sense of saying these were the best informations and the best models that we had available in 2004.
I have to say, to support your argument and to have a jibe back, and to sort of see if I can rouse some sort of economists, cost-benefit analysis is one of the major problems. I mean, if you take a wonderful approach and you look at London and the cheapest and the best place to put the new runway for Heathrow, it's actually Hyde Park, according to cost-benefit analysis. So you have to be very sensitive to people's opinion and value judgments. And with the climate change, is the Met Office model suggests that by 2050, half the Amazon rainforest could have burned and turned to savannah. Now, again, cost-benefit analysis is economically probably doesn't really affect the world economy that much. But do we value it? And I think that's a big problem with a lot of economic models, because it doesn't have intrinsic value to nature. And I think
I briefly got to get back to that. First of all, obviously, cost-benefit analysis would account for the fact that a lot of people relish the fact that there's a Hyde Park. There's probably also be a lot of noise problems. I do actually believe that that would not be true. Okay. And of course, the real outcome of cost-benefit analysis would try to take in all these things into account. There's no doubt, again, not everything is in a cost-benefit analysis. Like every model, there's not everything in there, right? But we're actually trying, and I think you have to respect the fact that a lot of smart people are trying to put in as much as we can into these models. And again, we are left with the discussion of saying, do we actually want to rather trust our intuitions or less good models than the ones that try to pull in the most that we have? The second part about the issue of saying, do we want the Amazon rainforest to burn? I think that's still very conjectural. But yeah, no, of course we don't. But do we want 3 million people dying from HIV/AIDS this next year? Do we want 2 million people dying from malaria? And the list goes on. Everything that's bad in this world, we don't want. Now, in an ideal world, we'd deal with all of them. But in a world where we clearly do not, I still think it's relevant to say, well, how much don't we want to do this compared to how much can we actually do something about it? And my question then becomes, do you want to save a million people from dying from malaria each year, or do you want to save 1% of the Amazon rainforest, which is what you probably, yeah, I'm just making up this number, but what you reasonably could do with the Kyoto Protocol, or postpone the burning of the rainforest? That, I think, is the reasonable discussion that we need to have. That is the prioritization discussion.
Okay, we have 1:58, and we have time for one last question from the man with the best T-shirt, row 3.
What do you mean?
No. Yes, please. Microphone.
There's no mic.
Microphone.
Here. Mic here.
Thank you for commenting on the T-shirt. I thought it would not allow me to ask a question, but anyway. At the outset, as a student of international media and cultural studies, I'd like to admit my neophyte status in economic knowledge with regards to Professor Lomberg. However, listening to his talk from the start, the first thing that I noted was that this idea of social action presupposes an idea of human agency, which then links to linear action, i.e. we can prioritize this, we can solve this, we can then move on to this, which is a problem right from the start. I think we know that it doesn't work like that. And that then asks the question, how is power distributed within society, in global society, in local society, and where do we draw those boundaries? So my question would be, is rather than involving economists who you say are unaligned and impartial, which I think is a very big jump to make, is rather say, why not bring into the Copenhagen consensus prominent cultural theorists, for instance, Laclon Muth, who talk about the civil society and reorganising things on local and global bases and the interaction between such. And then how on earth do you go from this to the actual mechanics of social change on the ground in mediated culture, which comes to my final concern, as with the professor on the far right, would it not be better to promote a society where we can structure social values, media and culture, and social action on holistic and ecological principles, which would then act in turn with a network society to promote a better society overall and then solve the problems on a much greater scale? And my final question would be, if not now with regards to these problems, when exactly?
I think we leave it with that thought. And sorry, please.
I'm all for. I think it'd be great. I mean, you should try to do that at your school. Try to have cultural scientists sit down and say, to what extent could you? No, seriously. I think there's a lot of value in having a lot of different disciplines doing this kind of prioritization approach. And there's certainly reason to say that cost benefit and these kinds of considerations are not the only things in the world. I think they're an important part of the discussion. They're an important part of the knowledge that we need to have. But they're certainly not the only thing. A lot of people, I always get a little surprised. First, people criticize Copenhagen Consensus for not doing enough, and then for doing too much, and then they end up criticizing it for not solving the entire world, which, you know, yeah, we're part of the solution, hopefully, but we're not the whole thing. You know, we give you a list, but it's not a coup by economists and saying, oh, now we're going to take over the world and this is how we're going to do it. I'm actually kind of happy that that's not what it's like, right? But it's an important input into this discussion. I fully support your attempt to try to restructure society so that we won't have any problems. I think that's, in a sense, where we want to go. But on the other hand, yeah, sure, it's an ideal, but I'm much more of a marginalist in that sense. I'm just saying, okay, what can we fix? You know, what can we fix now and within in a reasonable time span? So at the end of the day, I think setting priorities is going to be a discussion that we need to have on a democratic level. That includes everyone. I think a lot of different people could come with valuable contributions, but I think the whole point of putting prices and sizes on a menu that we already have is an important part of information. It is only part of that information, but it is one that should at least help us make better priorities. But I welcome, you know, I think, you, go ahead, it's not a registered name, so go ahead, do Copenhagen Consensus for, sorry? What happens if we run out of time? I mean, I'm probably not nearly as skeptical about. I'm not probably nearly as pessimistic about that. But the whole point is to say, I think we're all trying to better the world in different ways. I'm trying to do this by heightening the information. I personally think that's one of the best ways to go about it. But clearly, we might have very, very different kinds of views on it. I'm happy if you go along. I think we share that viewpoint of that we want to help the world. If we don't make it in time, we didn't make it in time, but I'm not sure we know how to do that better than what we're doing right now. In order for you to fulfill what you believe is the best things that you can do, I'm trying to fulfill this. I think most academics are trying to, you know, give better information so we can make a better world. At the end of the day, it depends on how does democracy use that information.
May I thank all our panelists. And if you're holding a ticket for this event, there is a drinks reception where you can talk further in the atrium to your left as you leave the building. Thank you all.